I want to start off, if I may.
You may.
By reading a quote from a different Babysitter's Club book.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. And I read it because I read it for the first time yesterday, and it hit me as apropos to this storyline. The quote is, "I'm tired of your bossiness, Christy, and that's not all. I'm sick of the meetings, week in and week out, and the rules, and the talent shows, and fairs, and contests, and field trips, and tantrums, and stomach viruses, and diapers, and feeding schedules, and sibling rivalries. I've had it. I'm 13 years old. I want to spend time with kids who act my own age and talk about something besides babysitting."
Are you reading Stacy versus the BSC right now?
It's one of the greatest books Mitzi and I have read out loud recently.
It's a really, really good one.
Mitzi was cheering for Stacy by the end of it. Like, actually cheering out loud at the end of the book.
It's funny because Stacy, probably not supposed to be the hero of the story as it's presented, but Stacy is undeniably the hero of that story.
She becomes the mouthpiece for what everyone's kind of thinking by this point in the Babysitter's Club, which is, don't you people have lives outside of the Babysitter's Club? And when you do try to have a life outside of the Babysitter's Club, are you cool with kind of being punished for that?
That is of a piece with the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad that you've gotten to that point when on their 83rd adventure, minus super specials, so something right. Like their 100th adventure, one of the girls finally breaks.
Yes.
Very good.
And it's Stacy, who is kind of the shiftiest character in the series. She frequently lies and bees a bad friend to her friends.
That's, you're not wrong, and I would also say she acts the most like a normal 13-year-old of any of them, or in Jesse and Mallory's case, and just a normal middle school student who's just about to hit high school and is about to hit like her catty peak, I would say.
And I would say that this week's topic of this show, does a really good job at sort of fleshing out a little bit Stacy's character in the movie, making her a little bit more understandable, and adds what I assume is a deleted scene to her storyline involving the other kids in New York.
There are a few that I am very curious. Okay, let's talk about what we're going to talk about first.
What are we even doing here?
I don't know what we're doing here anymore. No, I know precisely what we're doing. What we're doing is we're doing a show called Pizza Toast that is about Babysitter's Club adaptations and other ephemera. We've been talking about the 1995 movie for a while. My name is Christy.
My name is Phil.
And today we are talking about the children's adaptation, not the young readers adaptation of the movie. We're talking about the actual like target audience of the series adaptation of the movie.
And like we said, this is an unusual situation to be in, because this is a novelization that's not only written to resemble one of the actual Babysitter's Club books, but is written by one of the Babysitter's Club book authors, one of the more prolific of the authors.
Yes. So we've mentioned this already, but this the name on the cover is A.L. Singer, and for once a ghostwriter gets name credit on the cover of one that is targeted toward the like 8-12 set, which is huge. And A.L. Singer, as you've mentioned, is an anagram for Laurentius, because this is a Peter Laurentius novel. And
Peter Laurentius, who also wrote Stacy versus the BSC.
That checks out. He probably wrote Stacy and the Bad Girls, too, and oh, am I excited for you to get there. There's a very Stacy and the Bad Girls-esque scene in this adaptation that this is what I was wondering before I rudely interrupted myself to introduce our show. I was wondering if he invented these scenes whole cloth because he knows these characters so well, or if they were indeed deleted scenes.
Yeah, or at least, like, unfilmed scenes. Like, was he working off... Well, let's talk about... Let's talk about novelizations real quick.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Did you read novelizations as a young person?
I sure did, and I would sometimes read them of movies that I did not see,
yes.
Which is a weird thing to think about, and I have been thinking about it a lot recently because of books like this. The 10 Things I Hate About You novelization was one of my favorites, and I don't remember how long it took after that for me to actually see that movie. Now, this is a movie that I have rewatched as recently as a few months ago. Maybe in January, had watched it in December before that. That's one I revisit a lot. And as a kid reading that novel, there were definitely things that they had to remove to make it an novelization. And there were allusions to curse words and like more vulgar language that it didn't make any sense in the book. And then I saw the movie and I would say, oh, yeah, I get it now.
Yeah, because a lot of times novelizations are aimed at a younger audience than the movie is.
Yes.
So yes. They do like alter that dialogue.
Oh, definitely. Well, I mentioned on a previous episode that we in my house had the novelization, the junior novelization of the movie The Mask. Mm-hmm. And that was written with about a third grade audience in mind. And oh, boy, it was different from the movie.
Okay, so then you get to like novelizations like the classic novelization of the movie E.T., which is almost unrelated to the movie at times. William Kotzwinkel was allowed to just go ham on that screenplay and create character interpretations that are completely unlike anything that hit the screen. Scenes that aren't in the movie. Characters who didn't make it past like the fourth draft of the script.
Oh, wow.
There's a whole character in the E.T. novelization that was originally going to be played by Corey Feldman. He was cast in the movie, and he was supposed to be this nerd who was a classmate of Elliot's and found out about E.T. and like spied on E.T. and was like going to expose E.T. And he stayed in the screenplay long enough that when Kotzwinkel adapted it, he was just in the book. He's just in the book. There's this like creepy nerd hiding in the bushes throughout the book. And he was supposed to be Feldman's character.
That's so strange. So apparently, and I'm not surprised by this, you're a novelization guy.
Well, when we were kids, especially, like, that was sometimes the only way to relive a movie.
Yeah, because you couldn't necessarily get it on VHS or anything like just yet, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't on video, and you certainly weren't going to own it, like,
no.
In any capacity. So
no.
If you wanted to have your movie with you, you bought the paperback and you hoped it had your favorite lines.
Well, that is true, because I kind of grew up in the era of, like, the Disney clamshell VHSs. So at that point, I had those. But my parents were the ones buying my entertainment at that point. So I was not going to be able to get my hands on any actual movies, particularly any that were PG-13 and above. So the reason I was reading those novelizations is because every time I went and visited my late grandmother, which was about once or twice a month, she would buy me whatever book I wanted in a store.
Mm.
And I got some really offbeat YA titles this way. Some very good ones, but then novelizations as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, which isn't to say that novelizations are necessarily bad. I mean,
oh, no. No.
There's some authors who've made their careers out of them. They put in the work. They really try to make them as readable as they can and as worthy of rereading as possible.
Yeah.
But this Babysitter's Club one really occupies such a strange place because it's a novelization of a movie based on a series of novels that tries to feel as a piece with the series but isn't at all.
No, it really isn't. And to his credit, the author does his very best to make it sound like this, the way he has written, the way Anna Martin wrote the series, while also reflecting what happens in the movie. But that's hard to do when you have the character of Christy, who's so different from her character in the movie. And then there are also moments, there's one in particular that stuck out to me, at which, like, at one point, Claudia describes Mimi as her grandmother Mimi to the rest of the club. It's like, institutional knowledge dictates that if she said Mimi, we would know, but maybe somebody is picking this up and has never heard of these girls, and therefore we must clarify. There, a lot of stuff like that throughout, though.
There's a lot of just little bits and pieces. The novel is very much the movie, like down to dialogue, except because it's got that Larrangis like sheen to it, and he's doing a little extra legwork here to tie it into the Babysitter's Club universe at large. It does have those little like, oh, Mimi gets Claudia's like Janine gets mentioned,
as well as
we'll get to Sam and Charlie, to me, the elephant in the room, the big weird thing that made me like almost throw the book across the room when I got like two pages into it. Because not out of disgust, but out of like shock and I would say culture shock almost, is the fact that the book is not written in the first person.
It's so jarring because all Babysitter's Club books are written in the first person. Even the books that have different narrators chapter to chapter always get the first person perspective. And to me, that might have been a sensible way to do this if the plots did not intertwine quite the way they did, and if a few of the characters didn't get as much screen time or as little screen time as they did. Because it would be just Christy and Stacy alternating otherwise, right?
Except that, like, the books aren't shy about being like, meanwhile, Claudia was doing this, and I heard about this later, but here's how it went down.
That
and
is you're true. Like, no, they do
so
that.
They do that all the time. I was thinking this book could be done like a super special with with the alternating,
that was my thought. Like, and it even opens a bit like a super special, which is, it's my favorite part of the book. Mm-hmm. And I think you also seemed to like this bit that they have all written in the club notebook, all seven babysitters, and that is how you get a snapshot of all their personalities. And it's effective in a way that, as you said, is more effective than the opening narration of the movie.
Right. So we get these, and it's written in actual legit Babysitter's Club handwriting.
Like, yes, the
best. Character handwritings are correct. And it's the notebook, and it's each character getting their, just throwing in their two cents about kind of what they talk about in the movie, and a little bit what they talk about in like the narration and in those opening those phone calls and stuff. But you get like Marianne being like, I just babysat for the Radowskis and they painted their dog. And Dawn's like, I got Margie Klinger to eat vegetables. And so you have like, you get a feeling for who all these characters are. You get a feeling for what it is they do. And if you had those voiceovers instead of Babysitter's Club, sure, Mrs. So-and-so.
Just going to say, right? Instead of girl-girlfriend.
Even over girl-girlfriend, if they already paid the money to have the song recorded.
But no, you're right. There's a Jessie's entry is about getting tutus for her charges, which you automatically are like, oh yeah, Jessie's the ballerina. Right. And this is much more effective than watching her walk down the sidewalk with the line, why walk when you can dance, which is just
walk when you can, and then kind of doing something with her body that makes it look like someone told her to pretend to be a dancer.
And it's woven through pretty naturally, even like there are bits that would be clunky if they happened in dialogue. Like Mallory's is about identical twins, and then she mentions that she has seven brothers and sisters, and having the triplets helped her, like as brothers helped her in the scenario. And it doesn't read as Mallory has a huge family, and here is what you need to know about them. It's good.
We do not get a chapter two in this book, by the way.
We don't. We do not, because we can't run down all of the outfits. The outfits Stacy and Claudia are wearing, let's be honest. Are Marianne's parents together, or does she have it? Like, it's all, you got to get all of that in a chapter two, and we get none of it here.
We get Stacy, in the book we read, Stacy quits the Babysitter's Club. And in the next book, the chapter two is like, even though she's not here anymore, here's Stacy's story. And I'm like, why are you telling me this? This person is apparently not in the Babysitter's Club anymore. And we get three pages of like Stacy's history. So, but because this book exists outside of time and continuity, it's like, that's just, we'll find out any history we want to find out when we get to it.
Yeah. So other than that club notebook bit, it's structured just as a third person perspective story. Mm-hmm. And
except it bounces, it's third person omniscient narrator.
Yeah.
So it like, it zooms out and then zooms into the psyche of a character whenever they're like the focal point, including Koki, which doesn't do it any favors because Koki, even more so in the movie, in this book, is clearly from another world, like another, like a sitcom planet. And she landed in Babysitter's Club world, because even they're inside your head. Once you see her written as a book character, you're like, this is just a bunch of wisecracking, and like, she's a Nickelodeon character, and it doesn't fit in with the rest of the storyline.
Oh, no, not at all. She is just a flat villain. Like when you read the line that jumped out to me, and it jumps out to me in the movie, but it's even more egregious in the book, is squeezing Logan's bicep and saying "nice muscles." Mm-hmm. Like one of the dialogue like that's recorded in this book, and it's bad. It's bad to read. It feels gross.
I say Larangis did his homework and did he put in the work. Obviously, he wasn't going to put in like the extra work it would take to restructure the storyline enough to make it work as a super special, or make it. This is clearly like he took the screenplay and adapted it into his style. And kudos to him, though, for even trying to make some of this stuff make sense. One of the things I was hoping he'd clarify, though, that he completely didn't, and I never brought this up in any past episode, is why in the heck are all the babysitters and some kids at a stable? Why are they horseback riding? Why are they there? Why is everybody there? Whose horses are these? Why is Jackie on a horse? Why is it even filmed there? Did they just have a horse stable to use? And like, well, we're going to use, because that's not a thing. You would think that's something from the book. Like, oh yeah, the Babysitter's Club every week, they go to the stables and ride horses. But that's not a thing that happens. Horses rarely come up.
It absolutely isn't a thing that happens. Two of the babysitters are very interested in horses. They're horse girls. Mallory and Jessie are horse girls. Mallory is more intense about her horse girl persona and does go to a stable once or twice in one book.
In one book, and hates it so much she never goes back.
Well, Mallory doesn't stick to any goal, let's be real. Mallory doesn't.
She sticks to the goal of shaming aged children's book authors.
We can do a bonus episode on just the letter she sends to aged children's book authors.
But no, but like, when I saw the movie, I was like, oh, that's, I assume there's some kind of event or something, or maybe a kid's birthday party. But no, they're just all at the stables, and then Koki and her friends show up as if that's like a thing, like all the kids go to the stables. But that, it never comes back. It's not a plot point. Jackie doesn't fall off a horse.
Which is what then, you would think would happen if Jackie is riding a horse.
Right, right. The horse would spontaneously die or something. It's Jackie on a horse. And I was trying, let me see, I'm just trying to find, I can't find it. Larangis just basically just says, later at the stable.
It is literally just across town in front of the Stony Brook stables.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a thing. That's not a, I bet that's not on the map in the complete guide.
Oh, wait, no, there's the stable. There it is. Right off Elm Street. You take Chestnut Drive off Elm Street. It takes you right to the horse place. the Kendallwood Farm. It's Kendallwood Farm. Kendallwood Farm.
That, I think that comes up in a Little Sister book.
It's
this
right
is
next
so
door
important.
To Bart Taylor's house.
Of course, yeah. Bart Taylor not in this story.
Well, that was the mystery of the stable solved. Next episode.
Really know where to go with that. But that's never explained. He does, if they are cut scenes, probably there was a reason, a cut for time reason, although this movie is so short, that doesn't make sense. But there are scenes in here that are not in the movie that give you a little more context for what is going on. Like you mentioned already, the New York Friends scene.
Yes.
That is helpful. That illustrates something about Luca that we did not know, which is that he thinks Stacy is 16, for one thing, and also is starting to think she's a square.
So the scene is they go to New York and Luca's there with friends from like
study abroad. They had all met in London, apparently.
And they are not only cool kids, they are cool kids with fancy hairdos and cool kids with fancy hairdos who pass a flask around.
They do. She says, yeah, it's a fun little description, like a fun little age appropriate description about how they all look kind of like their eyes are a little hazy and mm-hmm. they seem not like zombie like, but they seem a little out of it. And then Stacy notices the flask.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And they offer her some drink and she's like, no. And they're like, ugh, like Luca, who's this? Yeah. Who's this square?
Mm-hmm.
And then they try to get into the club and that's when it all breaks down. But it is nice to get that, like, who were these people? Who were Luca's friends? Who's Luca?
We get more of him throughout. Like there are just little snatches of dialogue that give you a better idea of how much he liked her already. They have their first kiss early. It's when they're hiking instead, which would have been a more natural moment to include it in the movie anyway. Right. Yeah.
We still get the awkward, I'm going to come back in a year when you're 14 conversation.
Of course we do.
So, you know, they don't change Luca that much.
No, they don't. But they do. They do also explain, like, Mrs. McGill kind of drags her feet on them going to New York with Luca, which makes sense and would happen in the books. Like, she is very overprotective. And this is one of those things where Laurentius can kind of bring his knowledge, like his expert knowledge of the series, and say, well, her mom would not just let her go to New York. This is always a whole to do, even though her dad lives there.
Right, you know? Right. And her mom comes across as far less flighty.
Flighty was the word I was going to use. Like, she seems like an actual grounded character in this rather than like a sitcom mom.
Yeah. Less like a sitcom mom than she ends up looking in the movie. Also, when she pressures Stacy into talking to Luca again, it comes across as less heavy-handed than it's played in the film.
She doesn't seem to be like, go get back together with this boy so much as you need to get rid of this boy.
Yeah, like, just talk to him. He's here. See what he has to say. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, she does.
And they have a nice,
but what's
nice
weird is,
moment.
This also, the book also makes like sort of structural issues of the story stand out. Like the fact that Patrick doesn't show up until like well into the book. Like,
yeah, it's maybe about a third into the book, and Patrick feels as though he's there immediately in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Maybe because he's such a large presence.
He is a huge presence, yeah, massive.
With his handsome face and his hair.
It is interesting, like Laurentius describing the scenes of them bonding again has, like, it is more layered, and in part that's because it is a book, and it can be more layered. But there's a lot of, like, Christy trying to resist being charmed by him, which we don't get to see in the movie because there's not enough time or space for that. There's a great moment when Christy is looking at photos of her father and herself, and David Michael comes over and says, who is that man? She says, that's your dad. And he just walks away not caring about it. And that is one of the good Laurentius lines of, she wishes she also could not care about this.
Yeah, Laurentius is, and we've talked about him before, but he's very, very good in the books at this dialogue, realistic, taking you as a reader on a real journey through people's emotions throughout a scene. The books that he writes are usually the ones that typically have some of the better character scenes, where like the Stacy book we read, it's the monologue I read at the beginning, which I will get back to, is is dramatic, but it really feels earned. He really takes you through these characters' inner lives and their foibles and how they sort of butt up against each other. He's really good at showing the characters just naturally being in conflict, like people are. And I think he is able to take some of the clunkier bits of character development in the movie and sort of smooth them over with his narration and just be like, yeah, these are weird things for a grown-up to say to a child. But the child is aware of how weird it is, and the grown-up is, like, really kind of skeezy but charming.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you gotta get that.
The line about David Michael and Christy is, she shows him the photo, he says, she explains it's his dad, And the last couple lines of the chapter are, Christy watched them through the kitchen window. She envied David Michael. He didn't remember. He didn't feel a thing. And that's, it says a lot without really telling it. Like, that's a good example of him using very few words to illustrate, like, a much deeper concept. So, oh, Christy wishes she felt nothing for this man and feel like this is why the manipulation is working. You can feel her guilt a lot heavier in this book. And I'm not sure that's something that really needs to have a place in a Babysitter's Club movie, but it makes more sense here than it does in the movie.
And because Lorraine just knows these characters so well and is able to write to them, even though this is a Christy who behaves very differently than we're used to seeing Christy behaving, he makes it comfortable in that character. Like, because he's written this character so much, he knows this is an aberration, that the character is acting wild. And and so he justifies that in bits and pieces. It's that laying of just like, he nudges the narration enough so that we arrive in a familiar place, a more familiar place than we do watching the movie.
And that carries over to the other characters too, because he does try to give all of them something to do and some inner life. There's a good bit where one of the many times Christy abandons Claudia. Claudia is kind of muttering to herself after Christy leaves, saying like, yeah, thanks for doing this for me, Claude. I don't remember exactly what she says, but it is just a brief, I am so angry at Christy for making me do everything, but I can't say that because this is not first person. So we're going to illustrate it in me whining to myself. And it's really good. And it allows you to feel Claudia's frustration in a way that, again, the movie doesn't have time for that. And if it did have time for it, it doesn't give Claudia any, like, movie gives Claudia short shrift. We know this already. Yeah.
It also does a good job at showing, just by its ability to, you know, without having to have a budget or cut back setup shots or anything, it gives you a good sense of time as far as, like, Christy came up with the idea for the summer camp and now has abandoned the summer camp. Like, that this camp is still going on and she's just not there at times because she's with Patrick. And also you see how much of a burden she puts on Claudia. Claudia is trying to study, and also, but then Christy will just, like, keeps throwing tasks at her friends, and Claudia's like, I'm trying to study, and now I have to do this, now I have to do that. And it helps that ending feel a little bit more earned.
Oh, definitely. And not everyone gets a lot to do. There's only so much you can do in however many pages are here. 139 in this case. And, you know, we still need to have room for Mrs. Haberman. Still have to have...
Right.
Which actually is a very... that is the most accurate reflection, I believe, of what it happens in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, that is pretty much pound for pound the same dialogue and all of the same emotions you could have wrung from what's on screen there. That's in this book. He doesn't really embellish any of that or give you more.
No, but to the degree that it makes Mrs. Haberman seem like she's hardly in the story at all.
That's the thing. When she is supposed to be, like, tied for one of our three most important plots in this story. Because that's what it is. Oh, also, my thing that he doesn't explain, and I will never understand, and I wish someone would tell me, is when Christy has the time to do the rap with Ellen and Logan.
So the rap.
He makes fun of it a little.
Where is that? I was going to say the rap is, where is it? It's right here. The rap is commented on by Larangis, who says, clap, stomp, clap, stomp. Using their hands and feet, everyone began beating a rhythm. Claudia watched in bewilderment as they started rapping. Cut to the next paragraph. Yes, rapping. Next paragraph. They had planned it, written it out. And I'm like, that's Lorraine just going, I don't know how to do this. So I'm just going to tell you that there's kids rapping on stage and you're just going to have to go see the movie because this is absurd. And there it is.
He does clarify the song was hilarious, but also incredibly helpful. Now, you and I talked about how there's no way that song was helpful. No. But I guess seeing it written out, like the list of the things that are mentioned, I think you kind of go into a fugue state when you hear that rap.
Yeah.
And I don't remember anything from it aside from the brain, the center of the chain. So it seems unhelpful to me. But apparently Claudia really gets something out of it.
I was thinking about the fact that, like, if I was going to fail a U.S. history test and someone played me the song The Shot Heard Round the World from Schoolhouse Rocks and was like, you good? I'd be like, no, I heard the song once and I didn't really absorb it because it came as such a surprise that it happened. And again, Claudia was just like, what's going on? And they're like, think about the brain. It's about the brain. And I'm like, I would have been like, okay, wait, I'm having trouble with this for a few minutes. Okay, it's over. All right. What was this? And you're like, you're ready for your test, right? I'm like, no, wait. Did you write that? What is going on? Where's Marianne going? And she's like slinking away out of the park.
I do like that Claudia only gets a B-, by the way.
She does.
She gets passed by the skin of her teeth, and that is how well she could possibly do on the grounds of that rap. Oh, speaking of Marianne,
yeah,
they do add some depth to the Logan story, but I would argue maybe not enough.
I mean, Logan's around. And
he's there.
He tries to give Marianne a little more, like, something to do, but...
Something to do that's not just keeping Christy's secret and being kind of a, like, a quiet jerk to Christy's very obvious jerk.
He manages to say things like, she almost cried, or her tears... Something that the actress could not have pulled off at all, where she seems to have been directed to just stare blankly at something just off camera. We did start watching Josie and the Pussycats the other night.
Oh.
And when I pointed out to Alana, I was like, that's the actress who played Marianne in the Babysitter's Club. She was like, what? I'm like, yeah, that's the same actress. She's like, what? Because she's so animated and like jumping all over the place and like having a good time.
What a difference just a few years makes a few more projects makes, because she's not like the strongest performer in that movie, which is not a slight on her. No. It's a movie that co-stars Parker Posey and Alan Cumming as like, spoiler alert, co-villains. But all three of the Pussycats are cast really well in that movie.
Yeah.
And Josie's not supposed to be particularly interesting. The fact that she is just like a good peppy band leader, it's just right for her. This is not the role Rachel Lee Cook was born to play.
You know you're having trouble fleshing out a female lead when you start off the movie by showing them working on a car. Because that is like Hollywood shorthand for... She's got layer. She's complex. Okay, she's pretty, but she can fix a car.
She's like, they're both so adorable fixing that car, though. They sing a little song about how he's abused the accelerator and broken the carburetor. Oh, I like that movie. I like that movie just a little bit. So Marianne gets things to do here and there. All of the characters who got short shrift in the movie still get short shrift in this book, but less so. Like, there's just a bit more.
Yeah, Dawn gets her scene with Mrs. Haberman at the end. And one thing I like about Laranges' adaptation of that scene is Haberman's still not sold on these girls at the end of it. Like, she seems to soften a lot in the movie. She's like, I really like you, Dawn. In the book, she's more like, okay, you still wrecked my stuff.
You still ruined my summer.
Right. So,
and actually, like, I think also seeing it written out, it comes across to me, it's much more clear just how much they messed up her things. Because you really read, these are flowers that she can't possibly grow without making a lot of money and going to get the, like, it's shipping them in from other countries. Like, it is way more of a to-do than it is presented in the movie, I think.
It is weird that, like, in a Babysitter's Club book, an actual series book, if they met a war photographer who lived in their neighborhood, that would be a major part of the plot. Like, these are pictures from when I was in Vietnam in the 60s and 70s taking photos. That would, like, really factor in. This is sort of just tossed off. Like, yeah, I traveled the world.
No, that would be the magical adult of the book, which there are some of those somewhere down the line. But, yeah, it's... it is not okay. I mean, my thesis on this whole book is that, like, I'm more satisfied with this than the movie, but there's still so much going on here right. that I don't care for.
So let's talk about a boy who gets some of the best changes from Mr. Yes. Laranges. And I am talking about the redemption of Alan Gray.
You said while you were reading it, we both read it earlier this week.
Yeah.
You said that Alan Gray does not become the Joker in this and is not a person who would become the Joker in this. You are correct in every way possible here, because he is just a normal middle school boy, like a normal insecure, tries to be a class clown a bit, but kind of falls flat at it. He's just trying his best the whole time. He never does anything that makes me deeply uncomfortable on the page. Even when he does the flying thing in the movie, it's 10 times worse than it is written out, which is just him waving his arms around.
Well, and what I like about the book is they keep tying his antics into him entertaining the children. Mm-hmm. He's very much a part of the summer camp here, and he gets the job at the camp, and he's good with the kids. Like, they keep emphasizing that. Like, when he does the bird thing, he's not doing the weird hand flap thing. It's like he starts flapping his wings and he flies off. It seems like he does it because Don said something nice to him, and so he's like, psh, like he's like taking off, and then the kids see him and immediately start running after him.
Yeah,
like
probably he mimicking his motions if I know children.
Yeah, like, he's fun to be around. He's a goof. And he wouldn't be Alan Gray if he wasn't a bit of a goof. I guess that's the character.
That's the character as written, doesn't come across in the movie.
He's not malevolent like he is in the movie.
It doesn't make sense that Logan would be friends with Alan in the movie. Like, that's not somebody that Logan, this very almost aggressively normal kind soft boy.
I will say that in junior high, I was friends with this guy named Joe, and he was part of our group of friends. You know how you have your group?
Yeah.
And it was me and Joe and David and Jeff and Dale. And Joe was, he was the kind of guy who would like run up to you at lunch, grab your French fries off your tray, shove them all in his mouth and go, "You're going to eat these?" And then belch in your face.
Bad.
And
very bad.
You'd just be like, "Oh, Joe." But he was part of your group. Joe would, we'd be walking down the hall in eighth grade and like a girl would be coming towards us and Joe would suddenly scream out, "Butts, butts, I want your butts." And he'd shove me into the girl.
You know what? You have more insight into this than I do, but now I am thinking about it, and there wasn't really a group, like a clique in my middle or high school that didn't have the one member who was just a little goofier than the rest, or a lot goofier than the rest.
I think of Train Spotting, when Begbie glasses the guy in the bar, and later on, they're talking about how dangerous he is, and Rent says, "He's a mate, what can you do?" Like, to me, that's like probably the way Logan feels about Alan Gray. He's like, they're like, "That Alan guy's really weird, why do you hang out with him?" He's like, he's a friend, what am I supposed to do, not be his friend?
I guess that is true, and also just like, we know so few of the, we know a lot of them by name and nothing else, like the boy characters at the middle school. Like, yeah, we have a lot of ex-boyfriends or occasional boyfriends of Stacey and Claudia, but Alan is one of the only name characters, and probably part of that is he's more interesting to write than any of these, like, flat boy who likes Stacey characters.
Right, because we have Logan, we have Alan, and we have...
Pete,
yes, yeah, who I frequently confuse with Alan, but Pete's a different character.
Of course, yeah. And, no, so this Alan, there are moments when, like, okay, a fun running gag that... Loren just like takes and runs with in this book that does appear in the movie is Susie Barrett saying something outlandish about like alligators love flying or just like the goofiest things. And when she tells Alan something, he's very earnestly like, "Cool." And that never happens in the movie, but that is all I need to sell me on Alan as a guy who is decent with kids. And is also being altruistic, partially to impress Dawn, but he also seems to be enjoying himself a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of Susie, we get a few of the campers, their names. We get them fleshed out a little bit. We do realize that Nikki Pike is like one of the boys, one of the kids who shoots the donut over the fence. Like,
yes.
Or I think it's Nikki Pike. Or yep. Is Nikki Pike the one with the Band-Aids all over him?
No, that's Jamie Newton, who is also... but that is... Never was it clarified in the movie that was Jamie Newton. So that was right. Nice.
And that may be something Larangis just did, because he's like, I need to name these kids, and I know these characters.
I'm sure he did, because like you do have the group of kids that are... randos, they're not real. They're like Jonas and Emmy and one other kid, the people who, again, get the donut over the fence. It's nice that he was able to add in names of actual characters.
Mm-hmm.
But he still had to, I mean, he still had to work with Rosie Wilder, an invention of the screenwriter. Oh, Charlotte gets mentioned once, but is never in it.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
The screenwriter, Daylene Young, by the way. I screwed up and called her Darlene Young a couple of episodes ago. I kept saying Darlene Young. It's Daylene Young. And I only discovered that because I was having a devil of a time Googling her name. So I was like, why is Darlene Young not showing? Daylene Young. And if Daylene is listening to this, I apologize for screwing up your name.
I hope she's listening.
Of course she's listening to this. We wish her
the best. Yeah.
We've got one review on Audible now. Of course she's listening to this. Thank you, by the way, Audible listener, who has not gotten to this episode yet, for giving us a glowing review on Audible. I did not even realize you could do that.
I didn't know Audible reviews existed until you told me, and then I was very happy for the next couple hours after that. Who doesn't love positive feedback? Who doesn't love positive reinforcement?
If you listen to this on Audible, leave us a review. I think it's kind of cool.
It's pretty great that you can, yeah.
It makes us part of the Amazon family. So we get these kids, we get that fleshed out a little bit. Things just, because they're written down and you get the narration, plot points get connected a little bit better. I understand where they are in the summer. I understand where they are like in the universe. Like it feels a little less episodic and more like a Babysitter's Club summer adventure.
Yes. Yes. I would
but
agree
you're
with
right.
that.
I mean, but like Mallory and Jesse are still hardly there. I mean, mm-hmm. Becca gets named. Jesse talks to Becca at one
point.
Yeah.
Oh, both Vanessa and Margot Pike get named.
Mm-hmm.
Margot doesn't do what she does in the book, which is a thing that recurringly she does in the series, where she peels a banana with her feet. No one likes it, but Alan Gray does eat the banana.
Peels a banana with her feet. I can't even imagine a child doing that.
No.
Like, I can't envision how that occurs. So no. It is impressive.
It is. I can pick things up with mine, but I can't, and like, I've been able to do that since I was a kid. I do not have the dexterity. I don't know. One of my friends can tie a shoelace with his feet, which is, you know.
This is like a conversation from The Breakfast Club.
It kind of is. I don't like it. The ability to do that kind of thing, very impressive. Glad that that's written into Margot's character for some reason. And glad that Laurentius was like, why not?
Yeah.
Because that's definitely his invention. There's no way that was in the script.
Yeah, and he doesn't back away. He doesn't back away from it. Again, though, and I brought this up earlier, our villains, our ghostly trio... show up, and they do everything they did in the movie, from the stink bomb, which doesn't get described, by the way. It's just a stink bomb. It's not like an ornate piece of like medieval sculpture. It's not the holy hand grenade of Antioch. It is just a stink bomb. You the reader are left to imagine how that works and it is opened.
I prefer it that way.
But Cokie in them, because their antics are the same, because their wisecracks are the same, and because they are essentially the same characters as in the movie, and he doesn't really soften them or change them, they really stand out as not a part of this world. This isn't Cokie from the books. This is a weird Clarissa Explains It All character.
It's strange. They don't speak the same way the girls do. Their scheming is malicious. It's like the greenhouse destruction, when you read it, it really highlights how bad it is what they did to them. Like, it's very cruel. They broke windows.
So it says, From a branch of a nearby tree, Koki and her friends peered between the leaves. Koki smirked as she read the sign. Aw, they found a new home. What do you say we give them a housewarming party? A party? Grace repeated. Why do we want to throw them a party? Bebe asked. Koki rolled her eyes. I'm trading you guys in. After camp, as parents arrived, Claudia grabbed her... And you're like, no, wait, that's two different books. That's it's two different... I don't know.
It's jarring. It's a jarring shift. It is jarring in the movie as well, but we do at least have the opportunity every time they're on screen to hear their little sting and know that they're coming and going.
Here comes Koki and their crazy outfits.
The outfits are good. Let's not forget that.
So can I now return to the quote I read at the beginning?
I would love for you to. I want to hear your thesis on this because mine is so simple, which is this is better, but it doesn't justify the existence of the movie.
My take on this, and it sort of solidified when I read that part of the book, is so in the quote, it's basically Stacy fed up with the Babysitter's Club, fed up with the ridiculousness, fed up with all the rules, fed up with all the responsibilities and Christy's attitude and just the day in, day out having to think about the friggity fracking Babysitter's Club. And it got me thinking about the super specials, many of which take place during the summer, the mm-hmm. endless summer from the endless eighth grade year of the babysitters' lives.
Yes.
And how in the super specials, the babysitters are frequently separated and off doing their own thing. Sometimes they're together, but frequently the group is split up in various ways. And how, to me, the movie would almost justify its existence, or the storyline would almost justify itself, if the lesson at the end was, and this is just me like being like, what? Wait a minute. And I got this from Laranges' narration as well, which is the babysitters made the mistake in this book, in this storyline, of not giving themselves any downtime from each other. So Christy's big idea was let's have a summer camp, and that didn't allow any of them to have their own summer. Mm-hmm. And to me, the lesson you need to learn at the end of this is we can't spend all of our time together, or we're going to be on top of each other the whole time, and we're going to drive each other crazy. And even though we're the Babysitter's Club, we've got to have our own lives. Like, Christy's got to have time to explain things about her family, and Claudia's got to have time to study, and Dawn has to have time to save the planet, and Marianne has to have time to be with her sister. And, like, to me, that's kind of a cool idea for a Babysitter's Club, like, sort of full ensemble movie, is we're best friends, but we can't always be together. And I don't know, I was reading the book and they kept talking about how they were just kind of annoyed at each other and they getting like annoyed. I'm like, oh, it's because you made the mistake of doing a summer camp. Like, Christy started off the book by saying, I'm so worried we're going to like have a summer slump. And I was like, maybe you should have had the summer slump. Maybe you needed that downtime and then you can revive your club again when eighth grade starts all over again in September.
Okay, while you were talking about this, it reminded me of the final episode of the HBO series, yes, The Babysitters Remember, in which the final lines of dialogue, like the last exchange, one of them, it's almost certainly Marianne, says to the rest, like, what if we don't get to keep seeing each other? And the rest of them reassuring her, we might not see each other as often as we do during the year, but we'll always come back to each other.
Yeah.
And that's a much better, for me, that is a much better takeaway for the Babysitter's Club, just generally. And it is what, this is what should have happened here. Like, they shouldn't just all be looking happy in a photo together and that being the final shot. Like, we're all so happy that we're so close and we see each other all of the time. Because they're not so happy about that. Like,
yeah, I'm like, if you're going to make a standalone story for people who aren't familiar with the books, for people who are familiar with the books, but are looking for, like, what does a major motion picture of the Babysitter's Club look like? To me, a way to go is, like, explore the idea of what it means to be a group of friends who are always together. Mm-hmm. And, like, teach a lesson to kids at the end that, like, you're allowed to not be around. Like, I don't know. Like, to me, I've just been thinking so hard about this movie that I'm like, why does a Babysitter's Club movie exist? What do you do with a 100-book series when you're trying to, like, sell a 90-minute movie based on that property? Like, what do you do? I don't know.
No, you don't do this. Like, this is not what you do. I think you're right when we talked about the young readers adaptation, that had they limited to just that plot, the movie would function much better. But again, the conclusion of that book is that nothing went wrong the rest of the summer after they resolved their problems. And you need to have some kind of satisfying resolution. Here, the resolution in the movie and then in the adaptation is everyone is friends again at the end because everyone understands what Christy was going through.
Right.
And that's all well and good. Like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. It's great that they're friends. It doesn't address this larger issue that the summer camp was not a success. Like, they joke, yeah, oh, we made $18 so we can get a pizza. That's not good. This was not one of Christy's great ideas. This was one of Christy's ideas that kind of fizzled.
Mm-hmm.
One should have fizzled before it ever began. Man.
So, yeah. Babysitter's Club, eh?
How about that?
Whole novel. We read a whole novel for this show.
We read a whole novel, and I still, because I can't escape how much I love his interpretation specifically of the club, I still had a blast reading it, especially like any passage where he was talking about like Stacy's inner life in particular, yes, because he is so good at, uncannily good at the romance through the eyes of a 13-year-old girl bit. Mm-hmm. And he always has been. And that is a thing that is very hard to write, even as I'm a woman and I have a very hard time with that without making it seem kind of cloying and strange. But he's very good at it and always has been. And yeah, if that were the through line, that could be an entire book on its own.
I've never read any of Laurentius's other stuff. I'm only familiar with his Babysitter's Club stuff. I know that he is a published author in his own right. But it's his ability to, even in books that he may not have been like very emotionally invested in, personally invested in, to respect the characters and say their inner lives are real, their inner lives are messy, growing up is hard, and when a person's personality will never fully mesh with anyone else's personality, period. Mm-hmm. And just, he just sort of goes from there and you're like, right on. Like, it works. It seems real to me.
Yeah. And that's, I'm really glad that you're reading Stacy versus the BSC right now, because that is an excellent illustration of what he can do, like what he's been capable of doing with these characters.
Yeah.
And what he did for so long. I'm just thinking about that passage, and I'm also thinking about, like, do people ever think the baby... I haven't read the books in long enough to know, like, I don't remember this. Do people think the Babysitter's Club is weird for being so close to each other?
Like, in the books?
Yeah, like, other students?
No one ever comments on it. Like, no one really... You never get moments in the books where people are like, you're in that Babysitter's Club? The only time it happens is when Logan's made fun of it for it by his friends.
Yeah, because he's a boy babysitter. That's fine.
But no one comments on, because there's no other characters in the books. You don't meet other characters until Stacy meets her friends in Stacy versus the BSC, Robert's friends,
mm-hmm,
who just kind of are like, oh, yeah, those are your friends in the Babysitter's Club. Yeah, yeah, they're a little like, haha, they're a little funny, weird, but like mostly because they're kind of immature acting. But no one's like, there's this group of kids in our school who have a thriving business. Like, that's not like ever, that's never like taken into account. They hold 5 fun fairs a year. Like, that's never like commented on. None of us are allowed. I did like in the book where the girls, Stacy throws a party at her house and none of the babysitters except for Claudia are invited because it's Robert's party and she only wants cool people to be there and ride on.
Yeah.
The babysitters confront her on it later, and she's like, we don't invite anyone to our Babysitter's Club parties. We don't, and I don't invite Robert, and you don't invite Logan to, like, hang out with the babysitter. Like, we do a lot of stuff we don't invite anyone else to. Why can't I do that with my other friends? Like, and I was like, you're right, dude. Like, it's totally cool, Stacy.
The actual villain in that book, as ever, is Dawn, right? Because she spies on... Because
she dresses up like a spy and spies. But no, the actual villain in that book is the actual villain in that book is Christy, because Christy is up to her old irrational self in that book, where you're like, dude, you run a babysitter's club. Like, you read about Christy giving people the look when they're late, and then she keeps doing it, and you're like, you need to lighten up, kid. Like, you need, someone needs to tell you to lighten up, because you are rapidly running out of friends.
I do prefer book villain Christy to movie villain Christy, because I'm not saying she is not forced to, like, she's forced into the role of being the villain in the movie, right?
Right.
But at least book villain Christy has, like, this defined personality that we know so well and we have to find endearing, even when it is totally irrational.
They make fun of Stacy for having a boyfriend, when it is pointed out time and again that three of the other babysitters have boyfriends.
It's They're true.
Like, Stacy with Robert, and she's like, they have boyfriends. Christy's dating Bart. Mallory's dating Ben. Marianne is dating Logan. Why are they making fun of me for having a boyfriend? Never explained.
Sierra, I guess final thoughts? Conclusive thoughts?
I'll say that this is a book that people should have in their Babysitter's Club library.
Agreed. I think it's more important than some of the other spin-off type books, just because it's an interesting artifact in a way those aren't. I think I've touched on the Portrait Collection before.
Yes.
And an interesting companion piece to this book would be Christy's book. So the Portrait Collection is some of the girls, I think all of the eighth grade girls, wrote autobiographies of themselves. And they spotlight like four or five different stories of their, I would say growing up, but they're 13. So like their very recent past. And one of the stories is almost, in Christie's, an adaptation of the Patrick storyline here.
Right.
And it's all about how she begins fully viewing Watson as a father figure and as her dad, because of how Patrick has let her down. And that is given much more room to breathe. You get much more of real Christy and her like inner conflict of loving her dad because you love your dad and realizing he's not a good guy.
Right.
It was very good.
And those Portrait Collections didn't come out until much later than
They're a much later edition. I like them a lot. I don't know if I'd seek them out necessarily. Like
They're available digitally.
Oh, really? Maybe I'll seek them out then. But I don't remember the Marianne one or the Dawn one particularly well. So.
But yeah, 8 out of 10.
8 out of 10 of this book?
Again, not available. You can't buy this new. It's not available on like digitally. It's not available as an ebook. So if you're going to buy, I think I found my copy for like $4 or $5.
Mine was under, like, it was sub $5. It was on eBay. I think it was Thrift Books, the giant seller on there.
Yeah.
Had a bunch of them, and I was able to get the better than acceptable copy. Like, it's a pretty good copy. So the cover was slightly bent, but otherwise it's in perfect condition. It's got that cute little photo insert, like the many pages.
And it's got a hilarious photo insert of Koki and her friends, which is obviously a publicity shot, but like,
I really love that one.
Really odd in it.
They're looking through a bush and it's great. My favorite one is actually the really cute shot of Jessie. There's a picture of her in front of Christy's gifts, and it's very adorable.
It's very cute. My book is really banged up. Like, whoever owned this, like, read it like a few times.
That's what I would have done. Yeah.
It was only defaced at the very end. They drew a dead smiley face.
Oh.
A smiley face with X's for eyes. I don't know what it means.
That's a haunted book, and you maybe want to get rid of it.
It's the ghost of Mimi. There she is.
Oh, Claudia's grandmother Mimi?
Claudia's grandmother Mimi. So is that it? Are we done?
I think so. We got to figure out what's next, but we can do that off mic.
All right. Well, is it time to say goodbye to our friends?
I would like to say goodbye to our friends.
Where can they find us?
They can find us on Twitter at PizzaToastPod. They can email us at PizzaToastPod@gmail.com. And find me on Twitter at Admiral Christy, Christy. I'm locked, but I let anyone follow me. You can follow Phil at P. Corey Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? And apparently you can review us on Audible.
Yes. Review us on Audible. Review us on iTunes. Review us wherever you can review. Not just for my own like ego, but also because I think it's fun to hear what people think about the show if they listen to it.
I'm really curious about it. And I like when people thank us for having good chemistry, because that's not something I realized you could be thanked for and feel good about.
Yep. Turns out Christy and I are hungry for approval.
Who among us?
goodbye, friends.
Goodbye, friends.